Dr. Turco said he had dealt with criminal behavior often in his studies, particularly in constructing psychological profiles. When Shin asked him to explain to the jury what that meant, Turco said, "A psychological profile is a product of the technique that utilizes known psychological theory as well as very specific information to formulate an idea of what a person is like. This goes back a very long time. Freud himself did a profile on Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo by studying the work they did and their family background and information available." Turco went on to say that Freud had also done a psychological profile on Woodrow Wilson. Profiling was not a new technique at all. During World War II, a profile was done of Adolf Hitler. President Kennedy had received a psychological profile of Nikita Khrushchev. Constructing a psychological profile of a criminal was slightly different. "You don't know the person," Turco said. "If someone has committed a crime, you take information and put it together and try to then make predictions about a person you don't know. This is what happens with a serial murderer. Several people are murdered. We take information from the crime scene. We look at the way the body has been handled. We look at the blood splatter, the kind of weapon used, the specific nature of the assault, put together, and we hypothesize. We also try to take crime scene pictures and autopsy reports and study those, even when no body had been discovered. We take whatever information we have and we try to formulate a profile." Each type of murder has particular patterns, whether domestic, serial, stranger to stranger, or person to person. Turco and his fellow psychiatrists and criminologists had come to a place where they could predict with no little accuracy which types of human beings commit which crimes. Turco told the jurors that he himself considered four or five things when he did a profile: current behavior, development, physical health, and the psychodynamics of the crime. "If possible, I use the crime scene information." He stressed, however, that profiling was not a technique to convict. It was a technique to predict human behavior, used to aid investigators and all those concerned with the psychopathology of the criminal mind. Shin pointed out that, unlike some witnesses, Dr. Turco was not living in an ivory tower. "Tell the jury a little about yourself." "I have at least 10 years' experience as a homicide detective," Turco remarked. "I'm a commissioned police officer in the state of Oregon. I've investigated many homicides. Detective Rod Englert and I worked on a serial murder case together." In fact, Turco had worked with the FBI and with police agencies all over America. At Shin's request, he had reviewed a stack of documents on the Cheryl Keaton murder and read the long chronology of both Brad's and Cheryl's lives. "Almost too much, including a letter that Mr. Cunningham sent his mother," Turco said. "Mr. Cunningham," Mike Shin began, getting down to the case at hand, "is a man who, from outward appearances, seems to have the characteristics and background that were totally inconsistent with the kind of brutal murder that killed Cheryl Keaton. I want to understand what went on here between him and Cheryl Keaton." He asked Turco what he might have found significant in the materials he had studied on this particular murder case. "Outward appearances are not very helpful," Turco said. "At least in the everyday behavior observed by strangers. This is what we call a false self. The individual projects an image of what he is really not. It's only in the intimate situation that you find what he is really about. That's the so-called true self that is hidden." Turco cited Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, the Green Beret doctor convicted of killing his wife and small daughters, as an example of an individual who projected the false self. "His public image was exemplary," he said. Shin reminded Turco and the jury of Brad Cunningham's many achievements, his athletic stardom, his intelligence, his business career, where literally millions of dollars were under his control, his love relationships with any number of beautiful, successful women. "It's totally contradictory that he could do something like this, he remarked. Not at all, Turco said. The I-5 killer fits the profile you just gave of Mr. Cunningham. He was a football player, well-liked, had lots of girlfriends, very smooth, very social. That's Randy Woodfield? Yes. Ted Bundy is another person who would fit that category. We did the profile of Mr. Woodfield in 1980-81. It's not unusual. That's a typical pattern. It's one of the reasons why these people surreptitiously murder. Why not just get a divorce? Why not just leave town? But these people maintain a facade, an image. In order to do so, these people have to destroy someone who can show that they don't meet that image. They're destroying the evidence, so to speak. That's one of the reasons they always profess to be innocent. In a sense, they even believe that they had the right to do what they did. It's a narcissistic presentation. Malignant narcissism. Turco explained that people like Woodfield, McDonald, Bundy, and Cunningham had character disorders. They were unable to relate in any meaningful way to anyone. They had no consciences. It's the way they live, he said bluntly. Narcissists cannot love in a genuine way. It's an incapacity. It was indeed, he testified, a kind of blindness, an inability even to see that one is doing something harmful. In the materials about Mr. Cunningham, I see projection, particularly in the letter he wrote to his mother, Turco said. In projection, there's a tendency to take one's own feelings, usually negative feelings, and to project them onto the environment and anticipate that they will be coming back at you. He accuses many people in his life of doing things to harm him, a representation of his underlying rage. I think it's intimately tied up with the parental relationships. Turco went on to note a number of deliberately cruel patterns of behavior that Brad had exhibited, behavior he had seen again and again in depositions and testimony from both his former wives and his family. He commented particularly about the fact that his first wife, Lonnie Ann, had been totally dependent on Brad's child support checks, and yet he had invalidated them after he gave them to her, so that she would be destitute. Speaking of this kind of cruelty carried to the point of murder, Turco said, "We call it sadism. Egosyntonic sadism, which means there are people in this world who are just basically very comfortable with cruelty. It's almost a way of life for them to be cruel to others, in small ways and in big ways. Reading through these records, that pattern becomes apparent." "Could you give us an example?" Shin asked. "Behavior toward his former wives, to the women in his life. That's pretty well documented," Turco responded. "I think there's really a very serious indication of loss of impulse control. This person is not just cruel on a level of canceling checks or cheating. It has an aggressive component that's really quite substantial." Shin held up the letter that Brad had written to his mother on January 28, 1974, when he was 25 years old. "What does that reflect about his feelings about his mother?" he asked Turco. "Briefly stated," Turco said, "this letter reflects his perception of his mother as being very cruel and being a very inhumane person who is out to destroy his life and the life of his father. Actually, there are two elements to this letter. We would have to assume that his allegations are false." The letter that Brad had sent to his mother was 3 pages of single-space typing. It was packed with vituperative accusations, beginning by castigating her for her thinly veiled offensive to cover your own tracks because you had opened and destroyed my first-class mail. And, moving on, "You liken me and my father to conspirators in your divorce. You clearly know that your bizarre and unexplainable actions caused the man to seek out peace of mind away from you. His most serious heart attack was caused by one of your relentless ranting and raving sessions, your threats to kill people. I have made a concerted effort to divorce myself from your sphere of influence." Brad continued in his hate letter to his mother. You have ignored my right to quiet enjoyment, harassed my person, ostracized and impugned my character and reputation, attempted to alienate my children's affection. You have physically attacked the woman with whom I associate, calling her a slut and a whore and threatening to kill us both. You have pawed through my personal belongings like an animal. I can subpoena witnesses to state they heard you threaten to kill various people. You also said you should blow off my father's head with a gun. I speculate and believe that you will need the professional help of a psychiatrist. Without this assistance, I fear you may commit an irretrievable act in carrying out one of your earlier threats. Brad had ended his letter to his mother. Consider yourself informed as to my feelings on these matters via this letter. Any continuance of further actions on your part to harass, intimidate, or malign me or my family or friends will be met with appropriate and swift legal restraints. Yours, Brad M. Cunningham. Analyzing this letter for the jurors, Turco said, "You basically see an individual projecting his own rage, hostility, paranoia, etc., to another person. In this case, onto his mother. The second element, what is or isn't true, whether his mother is a terrible person or an angel, is irrelevant. It is that he views her as such, and that is extremely, extremely bad. The relationship with a mother is very important, and this letter is a projection of his own hostility. Take this a step further. Individuals who believe that their mothers are that bad almost instinctively reenact the same rage toward other women in their lives. They lack the ability to not be aggressive. They have the inability to relate in any fashion. This man doesn't have empathy. He's using people only to get something out of them. Do you notice that, not just in his dealings with his wives, but with his children? Shin asked. Yes, Turco agreed. I noticed that quite specifically. He's basically relating to them with respect to wanting complete control. Brad Cunningham's whole life with other people then had been one of wanting to dominate and to control. Would the words Jekyll and Hyde be used here? Shin asked. Privately, he often referred to Brad as either Prince Charming or Darth Vader. Dr. Turco said that this was just another way of saying true self and false self. He explained that the more a person's private self matched his public self, the more likely he was to be a pretty well-integrated person. Brad Cunningham had been two widely disparate selves for more than 3 decades. His wives had been drawn to a man who was a kind, tender lover, and had awakened to find they were tied to a man who detested all that was female. Was it possible that Brad had been in the grip of his own psychosis the night of the murder? That he was insane? Turco said he had studied the murder of Cheryl Keaton and discerned the M.O. of a person who had carefully and meticulously planned each detail. Because this was a civil trial, but mostly because Brad had chosen not to present a defense at all, the jurors were able to hear an extremely comprehensive overview of the psychopathology of a narcissist, an antisocial personality, a man certainly capable of murder. No defense attorney jumped to his feet to object. Shin asked Turco how a personality like the one they were discussing would relate to his children. "The children to him are objects, so to speak," Turco replied. "In other words, he owns them. This is an important issue to consider again. The father in this case wants to say, 'My children love me, I have them, I have control,' even though they may not love him. The other part of it is, he's going to hurt the other person by taking control of the children, a valuable possession, from this mother." Turco agreed that the fight over custody of the children, coupled with Cheryl's threat to expose Brad's tax irregularities, was more than enough to provide a murder motive for a man who fit Brad's profile. "It's the utilitarian use of people for one's own gain, malignant narcissism," Turco said. and this was a character and/or personality disorder that was totally untreatable. Brad Cunningham was not crazy, not insane. In Turco's words, he was totally in touch with reality. He was smart and charismatic and selfish and terribly dangerous, and still a completely free man. Chapter 51. It was nearing the middle of May, and Brad still hadn't appeared at his trial. His living ex-wives, however, were not all represented. Sarah had testified in person, but Brad's first and third wives were too afraid to do that. Lonnie Ann's videotape deposition had been convincing. Cynthia Marasco had talked only off the record. And only a month before the trial, Shin had traveled to where Lauren Stoneham lived to ask her questions about her memories of Brad while a court reporter recorded their words. Although Lauren hadn't realized it, she had important information. Brad had called her on October 5th, 1986, to tell her that Cheryl had been killed 2 weeks earlier. At that point, only the time the van had been found, 8:45 p.m., had been released to the media. "Brad said that the estimated time of her death was 8:15 p.m., Lauren told Shin. He said that he had been downstairs in the garage at his apartment house at that time. At 11:05 on Thursday morning, May 16, 1991, Mike Shin began his final arguments. He had to convince 12 jurors that the preponderance of evidence proved that Bradley Morris Cunningham was responsible for causing the death of Cheryl Keaton almost 5 years earlier. The jurors had listened to more than 5 dozen witnesses, visited the site of the accident, and looked at scores of photographs. Shin did not, however, have physical evidence to offer them. His case was purely circumstantial. Shin's opening remarks had painted a picture of the kind of woman Cheryl Keaton was, one of the most brilliant legal minds in the United States. All the lawyers who had praised Cheryl, he submitted, were effective witnesses, and yet it was the secretaries, the paralegals, the women she had worked with who had really given the picture of who Cheryl had been as a mother, a friend, and a human being. "Once I got involved in the case," Shin said, "we conducted an exhaustive investigation, including interviews with hundreds of people, and not one person in this entire world was found with a bad word to say about her, except perhaps Lauren Swanson, who thought Cheryl had stolen her husband, and later we found that wasn't what had happened at all. There was nobody who had any rational reason to murder this woman." Shin then moved through the facts of the case, stressing that not only had Cheryl's killer struck her 2 dozen times, he had been quite willing to murder other people who were driving on the Sunset Highway the evening of September 21, 1986, and who would have died in a multiple pileup of flaming cars. Shin admitted that one of the facets of his investigation was that he kept getting back such bizarre information that he himself doubted it at first. "Children's coffins, letters that Mr. Cunningham wrote to his mother, to Cheryl, to other people. I was afraid to present them to the jury. If people see this stuff, they're going to think it's just too impossible to believe." There was no mystery about who had killed Cheryl. The questions Shin submitted were why and how. He then began a litany of Brad Cunningham's sins, and he used as a framework the letter that Brad had written to his own mother, that diatribe filled with accusations and show-off vocabulary. It was an answer to a letter his mother had never written. Brad had done the same thing to Cheryl, written her answers to questions she had never asked. It was a familiar dodge for him. If answers to letters existed, then those letters must also exist. But all the searching in the world couldn't turn up the ugly letters Brad loved to cite. They had never been written. His letter to his mother was particularly chilling in that it was a prime example of projection. All the things that Brad accused his mother of were not her flaws, they were his own. Shin quoted the experts who had testified about the nature of Brad's behavior. He quoted those who had suffered because of it. "The horror is unimaginable," he commented after giving many examples, "except that it's come from so many sources." But Cheryl had been prepared to stand up to Brad, and he couldn't allow her to live to bring her witnesses into the courtroom. He could not allow her to talk to the IRS. He could not allow her to have sole custody of her sons. "You know what a beefeater is?" Shin asked the jurors. "I never did until I went to the Tower of London on a rugby tour. I found out a week before this trial from Dr. Sardo that Brad asked him to keep a secret." "What is the secret?" I asked Dr. Sardo, and he said, "Brad believed that Cheryl and her mother were going to poison him." When I asked Sarah if Brad was really serious about the poison plot, she answered, "Yes, he was so serious that he had his own son sample his food first to make sure Cheryl wasn't poisoning him." "He was making them beefeaters," Shin said. "Kings had beefeaters who would taste their food, and they would watch them for an hour to see if they died of poisoning before they would eat the food. That's how much Mr. Cunningham thought of his sons." Mike Shin had spoken for 52 minutes when Judge Hegarty broke for the day, and those in the courtroom walked, blinking, into the warm May afternoon, their minds filled with the horror of malignant narcissism at work. Shin began the next morning with a description of Brad's character, calling him a tyrant and a coward. He commented on Brad's collection of guns, his arsenal, bulletproof vests, his hideout in the woods, and his police car. "Where's his military record?" he asked the jury. "When this country needed men who were really men, that had to use guns, where was Mr. Cunningham? He's my age. I haven't heard about any disabilities. Why didn't he go to Vietnam or to the desert? Mr. Cunningham was trying to get rich. He was collecting automobiles, Mercedes-Benzes, stables of them." Shin pointed out a pattern in Brad's behavior that was so clearly predictable. "Mr. Cunningham uses vehicles against women, stealing cars, hiding keys from his wives. When Lauren Cunningham was delivering her baby in the hospital, he calls her up. 'I've just repossessed your car.'" It was true. Brad collected exotic cars as symbols of his masculinity. He also used them to get even with the women in his life. He had killed Cheryl in her car. Step by step, Shin reminded the jury of the many bizarre actions that witnesses who knew Brad had testified to. Using charts, photos, maps, and the videotape of the reenactment of the crime, he once more called up the last moments of Cheryl's life. He sounded angry. He was angry. It would have been impossible to spend so much time immersed in her life and tragic death without coming away with a compelling need for justice. Brad Cunningham was not there in that courtroom on Friday, May 16, 1991. But his image was flayed, pinned to the wall, and laid out for the jurors to study. He was a coward, a con man, a sadist, a monstrous father, a faithless husband, a killer. The jury retired to deliberate. Mike Shin had not suggested to them a specific amount of damages. He asked only for a verdict that would serve as a memorial to Cheryl, so that her life didn't end in total vain. "You're the only people who may ever have the power and the authority to bring some kind of deliverance to the victims, her little boys." With her death, half of them died too, maybe more. "Bring back a verdict that reflects the conscience of you people. A verdict that will follow Mr. Cunningham around the rest of his life, one that will reflect his ego and that he will take notice of." The jury would decide whether to award money for Cheryl's wrongful death, the pain and suffering of her children and their loss of their mother, as well as punitive and exemplary damages. Deliberations took a little more than 5 hours, and even Shin was shocked at their decision. They had agreed with all of his arguments. They believed that Brad Cunningham had indeed beaten Cheryl Keaton to death, but they went further than he could have imagined. Shin had privately been hoping that they might return with a judgment of $15 million. He wasn't naive enough to think that the money would ever actually be paid. It would likely be a Pyrrhic victory. Brad would undoubtedly claim poverty. The jury had added in losses that even Shin hadn't thought of. There should be money for Jess, Michael, and Philip to go to college. There should be money for counseling. They announced that they had awarded Cheryl Keaton's estate $81.7 million. It was one of the largest civil judgments, if not the largest, in Oregon history. Interestingly, for a man so hard to find, television camera crews had no difficulty locating Brad in Houston. Sitting on a couch in his tastefully appointed apartment with his sons and Dana standing nearby, he said that no one knew the pain he had suffered over Cheryl's death. "I miss her, terribly. I had nothing to do with her death, and yet my whole life has been ripped apart, as if I did," he said with a slight catch in his voice. He refused to discuss any evidence or suspicions that linked him to Cheryl's murder, but he said, "Yeah, I would like to know what happened to her. This has been a very tough time for my family, and it's very difficult on me. I'm not the same person I was a year ago or 2 years ago. Just a lot of unnecessary pressures and stresses on the children, and I, reading what's been printed in the newspaper, the people not hearing any other side of the story, and us being unable to give that other side of the story. I have no money to fight this. The boys and I live on Social Security. We have very little money. We haven't had hot water in our house for some time. We haven't paid our rent. We're not being evicted, but we're leaving." How could he be expected to pay Cheryl's estate $82 million? Jess faced the cameras. "It makes me kind of sad because he had to go through that," he said. "He's my dad. I love him. He couldn't have done what they said he did." And then the cameras followed Brad, Dana, and the boys as they stepped into a taxi. Dana looked like a movie star in her clinging blue dress and dark glasses, and Brad smiled benevolently at his sons. Chapter 52. When the trial was over, several jurors said that they were going to write letters to Governor Barbara Roberts and Attorney General Dave Frohnmeyer to urge them to seek a criminal indictment against Brad Cunningham. "I think everyone on the jury felt he was responsible," said juror William Tyrell. Charlene Fort, the foreman, said, "I think he should be tried in a criminal hearing." Brad's aunt, Trudy Dreesen, denounced the trial and questioned the motives of everyone who had testified against her nephew. "All this that's being said about him is a landslide of lies and network of half-truths and twisted things," she said. She would die believing that Brad was a sad young widower who longed only to care for his little boys. Washington County District Attorney Scott Upham declined comment on the verdict. "The Keaton case is open, and it has always been open," he said. "It's being actively investigated by the Oregon State Police." Pressed, he explained the concept of double jeopardy and the conflict his office had faced since 1986. The civil verdict put the DA's office in an uncomfortably hot spotlight. It had been between a rock and a hard place for almost 5 years now, agonizing over which way to go to see that permanent justice was done in this case. But it had yet to seek a criminal prosecution against Brad. Mike Shin had done a masterful job of proving Brad civilly responsible for Cheryl's death. He had given the jurors the clear and convincing evidence required for a wrongful death suit. Still, most people watching television and reading newspapers didn't have the faintest notion of the difference between winning a civil case and winning a criminal conviction. Shin now had tossed a gauntlet in Scott Upham's direction, and it wasn't a subtle gauntlet. In his final arguments, he had said in plain language that the justice system in Washington County has been either too impotent or too cowardly to deal with it. The legal system has utterly failed with this individual. In this case, justice delayed was not justice denied. It was, however, justice delayed once more. Upham had never given up on his quest to gather enough evidence to convict Brad of murder in a criminal court. In a sense, Mike Shin's civil victory heartened him. But in another sense, it was as if someone had just lit a red-hot fire underneath him. Shin had had three distinct advantages in the civil trial. One, he was unopposed. Two, he had only to win with the preponderance of evidence, while Upham would have to prove that Brad was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And three, many witnesses called in the civil trial would be considered hearsay witnesses or witnesses to prior bad acts of the defendant and never would be allowed on the witness stand in a criminal trial. As Upham explained to Oregonian reporter Joan Latz, "Those rules are put in place to demand that prosecutors seek justice. Suspicion, feeling, innuendo, and motive do not amount to evidence. And a man cannot be convicted of murder simply because he is a mean SOB. Sometimes similar transactions, similar crimes from a defendant's past, can be admitted into a criminal trial, but their admission has often opened the door to appeals." Upham and his chief investigator Jim Carr, not Cheryl's brother, whose name is spelled Carr with a K, and Oregon State Police Detective Mike McKernan finally decided to pursue a criminal indictment against Brad. If they failed, they failed. If they got a criminal indictment and Brad was acquitted, he would go free. It was a risk Upham was prepared to take. For Mike Shin, it was over, or as close to over as it could be for anyone who had just jousted with Brad Cunningham. Gratefully, he vacated his latest hotel and returned to his houseboat. He was sick of hotel food, sick of city noise, and he wanted to be back in his floating home in the wild preserve. He had no reason to feel any safer. In fact, he had reason to feel less safe. Brad was still free, but the civil trial was finished. 2 years of intense investigation had paid off. It was time to move on. Scott Upham was an Oregon native who had attended Portland State University and got his law degree from the University of Oregon. With his thick, rapidly graying hair and a luxuriant mustache, glasses, and tweed jackets, he looked like a college professor. He was serving his fifth term as DA of Washington County. Hillsborough is basically a small town, and Upham was so approachable to his constituency that his name was listed in the phone book. It was not unusual for his evenings to be interrupted by someone who had a quarrel with the judicial system of Washington County. "They have the right to complain," Upham said. "It doesn't happen very often, and it helps me keep in touch." In his mid-40s, Upham jogged, worked out, and played golf, soccer, and softball. He liked a beer after work and, most of all, a good cigar. He was a familiar and popular figure around Washington County. He was also an excellent courtroom strategist. He knew his cases inside out, and he was rarely surprised by anything the defense might throw at him. He was a man with a wicked, deadpan sense of humor. But by mid-1991, he had lost all sense of humor about Brad Cunningham. gathering enough evidence to return to a grand jury and secure a murder indictment, and then trying the case in court would prove to be the toughest challenge of Upham's career. If any man knew the ins and outs of the legal system, it was Brad. There's a special kind of stress inherent in preparing for a criminal trial, any criminal trial, and when it's a homicide case, the stress grows exponentially. Upham and his wife Mary Ann had three children, two daughters and a son. They were planning to build a new house. But with the Cunningham case, Scott and Mary Upham would find that they scarcely saw each other often enough to draw up plans for a chicken coop, much less a house. Before Upham was finished with the probe into Brad's past, both criminal and personal, his office and adjoining rooms would spill over with 30 thick three-ring binders and 24 cardboard boxes full of detailed information. Had Cheryl's body been found a few hundred feet to the east, her body would have occurred in Multnomah County, the most populated county in Oregon, with, naturally, a much bigger DA's staff. Indeed, the Toyota van was discovered so close to the Washington-Multnomah County line that Upham could still have chosen to decline the case and turn it over to Multnomah County. He just couldn't do that. As she did everyone else, Cheryl Keaton haunted him. Brad simply ignored the $81.7 million judgment against him in the wrongful death suit in Portland. It was as if it had never happened. He was concerned only with his multimillion-dollar lawsuit against the Houston contractors. He and Dana and his sons were living in Houston again, and living well. He had lost, but in Brad's mind, he had won. Sarah hadn't seen her sons for more than a year, and she was thrilled, if cautious, when she received a letter from Philip on September 6, 1991. She recognized Brad's distinctive printing on the green and white envelope and saw it was from Vinson and Elkins in Houston. Sarah immediately wrote to Philip, enclosing a $100 check for his birthday, and sent it by certified mail.
"I was so happy to get your letter. I love you, Philip. How are Jess and Michael? Tell him I miss them, too, and I love you all very much."
Sarah knew Brad could not resist cashing her check. He would have to show identification, and she hoped she might get the address where the boys were living. She had seen them all on the television news when Brad proclaimed his innocence and pleaded poverty. She watched, horrified, as Jess faced the cameras and mouthed the words she knew Brad had programmed into his brain, just as he dictated their letters to her. When her plan to find out his address worked and Sarah tried to learn more about the boys, Brad was furious. Jack Kincaid was trying to help her see the boys, and Brad vented his rage on him, too. Kincaid's opinion of Brad was, if anything, lower than Brad's of him. Kincaid never called Brad by name. He referred to him simply as Killer. To intimidate Sarah, Brad resorted to a familiar tactic. He sent a fax to Providence Hospital full of venom and ugly aspersions on her, hoping it would circulate around the hospital. Sarah, you suffer from both physical and emotional afflictions, demonstrated by your cruel toying with the children's minds and emotions. You also have symptoms of the Burke syndrome, wherein the sufferer wrongly punishes the minor children of an individual they do not like. I know so well of the hatred you harbor for me. God knows how you have inaptly demonstrated it in your failed collaboration with Michael Shin. How you can fabricate and lie under oath amazes me. Your outwardly attractive appearance and seemingly sweet facade hides the conniving control freak that you really are. In the facts, Brad described Sarah as a manipulator and a career wrecker who enjoyed having her friends and associates feel sorry for her and who deliberately contrived stressful situations. He also named names of physicians at Providence and said that Sarah had started rumors about them. His loathing and disdain for Sarah oozed from every line. He knew how to hurt her, and that was to chip away at her image as a mother and her love for the boys. "You have a duty to pay child support for Jess, Michael, and Philip. Yes, they have suffered, and yes, all I want from you is money. I only wish I could give the boys a mother. You have never learned the art of love and caring necessary to be a parent. Wise up, Sarah. Quit trying to punish me for Lynn. I never got a chance to tell you this, but you are not good at the heterosexual thing. Better watch out for Jack before he finds his Lynn. Get a life. Pay child support. My only goal in life is to raise my boys to be healthy, inspired adults. Please, Sarah, stay healthy, work hard, make lots of money, and pay all your back taxes so I can subpoena your ass when it is necessary. I have a good life with the boys. I am also getting incredible sex. You should be so lucky if she would only give you lessons." The fax was the antithesis of the love letter Brad had once written to Sarah, begging her to come back to him. Now he hid nothing. As it so often did, his fury ate like acid on the pages of his handiwork. "I have ventilated all I want to. Thanks, I feel better. Brad Cunningham, care of family in Linwood." Fortunately, the scarless fax was tossed unceremoniously into the wastebaskets of hospital employees who were all too familiar with Sarah's problems with her ex-husband. Brad's letter only served as further proof of his genius for projection. Most of the characteristics he attributed to Sarah were his own, and the newly discovered Burke syndrome was, of course, a slap at John Burke, the trustee of Cheryl's estate. By the spring of 1992, Brad felt he had done as much as he could on his Texas lawsuit, and he told Dana that they would be moving north. Although she had never been that fond of Houston and its humid air that was almost too thick to breathe, Dana had become somebody in that city. She was Angel, the most popular dancer at the men's club, a kind of celebrity. And now she had to quit her job and trail after Brad. Still, the pattern of their relationship had long since been established. When Brad and the boys pulled out of Houston, Dana was with them. They moved first to Mill Creek, an affluent area north of Seattle where Brad rented a $250,000 house. Dana had to sign the lease. Brad told her he would never have made it past a credit check. His aunt and uncle, Herm and Trudy Dreesen, lived nearby, virtually the last of Brad's relatives to stay in contact with him. Dana's world with Brad had become akin to living in a velvet and silky prison, and now she was looking for a way out. Before, there had been times when things were bad, but somehow the good times balanced everything out. That was no longer true. "I couldn't be with Brad any longer," Dana said later. "Things were getting too dangerous, too weird. There are things that I'm still afraid to talk about." For one thing, Brad was carrying a gun, and he was building up a small arsenal. He was obsessed with guns, with assault weapons, and with paraphernalia like handcuffs and restraining devices. Dana was back in the Northwest, back where she had friends and family. She wanted desperately to leave Brad. It was not that easy. "He wouldn't let me go," she remembered. "He said, 'Just be with me, just live with me, and we can have an open relationship. Just live with me, and I'll take care of you.'" What Brad meant by an open relationship was that Dana could date other men, but she could not stay out all night with them. "If I came home the next day, I got in trouble." Why would she even consider an arrangement like that? Dana had been under Brad's thumb for 2 years. She had lived his life in his world. She had dressed the way he wanted her to dress. She had even become an exotic dancer because it was what Brad wanted. He had convinced her that she was too uneducated, too dumb to ever make it on her own. And yet within her, there still beat the most primitive need that any human has, the need for freedom. Dana didn't have the strength to leave Brad completely. She was afraid of him, and she was afraid that she couldn't make it on her own. She took the only bit of freedom he allowed her. He let her date other men. Even so, she sometimes had the feeling that he was nearby with a camcorder filming her with other men. It wasn't anything she could ever prove. It was just a feeling that made the back of her neck crawl. Dana met a very handsome, very nice young professional man who, ironically, had close connections with the judicial system. They dated, and Dana kept her agreement with Brad. She always came home to sleep. But one night she didn't come home. It was almost 2 p.m. of the next day when she returned to the huge house in Mill Creek. Brad met her with an accusation. "You're in love with him, aren't you?" he shouted.
"No, I'm not," Dana said truthfully.
She had come to enjoy spending time with the young man who'd treated her like a lady with half a brain in her head. She didn't love him yet, but she loved being with him. Suddenly, Dana witnessed a terrifying transformation. Brad slipped into the blackest rage she had ever seen.
He started breaking glass and breaking furniture.
As Dana cringed, horrified, he became almost animal-like, crouching and growling.
"I guess maybe when he played football," she said later, "they acted like that. He was making terrible grunting, growling noises, and I ran away from him. He came after me until I was trapped, crouched in the bathtub with my back against the wall."
Dana thought she was going to die. Brad was so infuriated because she had disobeyed him that he was going to come into the tub and kill her. Her thoughts skittered frantically. What could she say to calm him down?
"I told him I loved him. I kept saying I loved him. He left for a few minutes, and then he walked back in, and, oh God, he was carrying a loaded .38 in his right hand. But he had both hands closed around the gun, and he was pointing it up at the ceiling. Then he said, 'You're gonna hurt me, aren't you? You're gonna hurt me like everyone else.'"
As far as Dana knew, Brad had done most of the hurting in his relationships with the women who came before her, but she wasn't about to argue that point with him.
"No," she said. "No, Brad, I'm not going to hurt you. I love you."
"No, you're going to hurt me." To Dana, it seemed that awful scene took hours and hours, but she knew it probably lasted only 15 minutes from the time Brad erupted into his animalistic rage until it was over. She was trapped in the tub, screaming out that she loved him and wasn't going to leave him. He was aiming the gun alternately at her and at the ceiling.
"And then suddenly Brad just slid down the wall," Dana said, "as if his legs were collapsing under him. I went to him, and he took the gun and put it to his head. He was completely relaxed then, with the gun pointed at his own head. I don't know what he did next. I ran. I took the stairs in 2 leaps and ran to the neighbor's."
She called the police from the neighbor's house, and the local authorities soon discovered that Washington County, Oregon investigators were very interested in the whereabouts of one Bradley Morris Cunningham. Oregon detectives came north and took Dana back with them to Portland. She was scared enough and fed up enough to want to tell them what she knew about Brad. The problem was, she didn't know that much, although she gave her permission for them to go into the Mill Creek house to remove guns and other paraphernalia there.
"I stayed in a hotel in Seattle the first night, and I didn't sleep," Dana remembered. "I didn't sleep in Portland either. I finally went back to Seattle because I was tired. Brad found me. He started with the same thing. 'You're my wife.' But I wasn't his wife. And I can't live without you. He made promises, promises, promises."
Dana went back to live with Brad. She missed the little boys, and she wanted to believe his promises. It didn't last, and she knew that if she ran again, she would have to run farther. Her youngest brother, Barney, who was only 20, went up to Seattle to help her get away. "Barney took me to my sister's house in Florida, and I thought I was safe." She wasn't. Frustrated, Brad was a force to be reckoned with. He reverted to type. He gathered together all the pictures he had of Dana in lingerie or revealing costumes and had dozens of prints made. He wrote a devastating letter detailing every small slip from grace that she might ever have made, and then he started faxing. "Brad faxed letters and photos to my parents, the bank in my little hometown, our church, my parents' friends and customers, all my friends. He told everyone that I was a stripper. He told my parents if they didn't tell him where I was, it would get worse." It did. Brad put all of his business schemes on hold and drove to the little town in southern Oregon where Dana had grown up. He actually stalked my father around town, trying to see if he would lead him to me. He contacted my high school friends and told them lies. Dana shuddered, remembering. "My mother was so horrified by all the letters and pictures and the things Brad was telling people. I told her, 'That's not true, Mom.' Sometimes I blamed my parents for even believing the things he was telling them about me. Brad was clever. He knew how to divide a family, and gradually he was tearing our family apart. He thought I was in Oregon, but I wasn't. I was in Florida. It was my family that he was putting through hell." Eventually, Brad wore Dana down. She couldn't let him destroy everything her parents had worked for, their position in the town that had been their home for decades. He sent her messages through her family and friends, and the message was always the same. "For every day you stay away, it's going to be that much worse." It was too much for Dana. Stronger women than she had been broken by Brad's relentless campaigns. He never quit. He never let up. In time, she knew, he would find her, and in the process her family would be destroyed. She remembered the words he had said to her so often. "I can wait 3 years if I have to get back at the people who have screwed up my life, because I have patience. I can outwait anyone." Dana knew that Brad had a long list of people he blamed for screwing up his life. Mike Shin was on it. John Burke was on it. Just as Brad insisted her own family was infected with Malloyism, he had invented a disease he now called Burkeism, whose symptoms included everything Burke had done to prevent him from dipping into the assets Cheryl had specifically earmarked for her sons. Brad had bragged about stalking Burke one day as he left the offices of Garvey Schubert in Seattle, following him down Madison Street and waiting while Burke, unaware, browsed in a bookstore. Later he found out where Burke lived, and Dana had ridden along when Brad located his house on one of the San Juan Islands. He had brazenly driven up Burke's road and taken his time observing his enemy's house. Dana knew all too well that when Brad wanted to find someone, he would do it. And in early 1992, he wanted to find her. "I went back to him," she later said ruefully. "I'd had it. But this time, I had a plan. If I could convince Brad that he had completely alienated me from my parents, then I figured he would stop sending letters and faxes down there. I told him that I blamed my parents, not him. And he believed me. He left them alone. I had no family any longer, but at least they were safe from him." Chapter 53. Brad never stayed long in one place. He moved from state to state, from town to town, even from house to house in the same town. One day in the summer of 1992, he told Dana that they were going to Canada, so once again they packed up. It wasn't a long trip. Brad had selected White Rock, British Columbia, which is a few miles north of the Canadian border beyond Blaine, Washington, and only a 2.5-hour drive from Linwood, where the Dreesens lived. Their White Rock rental was just across the railroad tracks from the beach and the endless stretches of the Straits of Georgia leading to the Pacific Ocean. It was a lovely spot, but Dana could see that Brad was becoming increasingly weird. It was difficult for her even to visualize the handsome young executive who had driven a Mercedes and lived in the Dunthorpe mansion. Brad still spent money, all right, but she had no idea where it came from. She assumed it was some kind of advance on a settlement in the Texas lawsuit. He wasn't working, although he bragged about some projects he and his Uncle Herm were discussing. On July 24, 1992, Brad and Dana had gone down to visit the Dreesens. They were in a grocery store, and Brad suddenly started shoplifting small items. He was laughing. It seemed to be a game. The things he was taking weren't worth very much, but he was stealing them. The store's security guard followed Brad into the parking lot, and they struggled. Brad maced the security guard, Dana remembered. He was carrying Capstun, a powerful pepper spray police use to stop assailants in their tracks, and he used it on the store guard. He was detained and arrested, but refused to give his name. Booked into the Everett, Washington jail as John Doe, he was eventually identified and bailed out and disappeared. A felony warrant was issued for his arrest on assault and theft charges. Back in Canada, things were tense that summer. Brad talked a lot about the apocalypse that was coming. He seemed obsessed with natural disasters and what would happen to them if one occurred. Dana didn't know what the apocalypse was, but it made her nervous hearing Brad talk about it all the time. Sarah tried in vain to see the boys the summer they were in White Rock. Brad always waited until the last minute to notify her that she had to be in Vancouver or Victoria within 24 hours if she wanted to see Jess, Michael, and Philip. Dana knew he was making it impossible for Sarah to get there in time from Portland. Brad had always been a stern disciplinarian with his sons, but there was one incident that summer that unnerved Dana. He had a puzzle ring, silver links that could be entwined so they looked all of a piece. One day, one of the boys was playing with it and lost it. Brad was enraged. He asked Jess, Michael, and Philip which one of them had done it, Dana recalled. And none of them would admit to losing his ring. He got the car, and we all went for a drive, and all the while he was trying to get the guilty kid to confess. They were scared, but they wouldn't tell. When they came to a lonely place far from town, Brad opened the car door and ordered the boys out. "You'll stay here until you decide to tell me the truth," he growled, and then drove off as Dana watched the three little boys' images grow smaller in the side-view mirror. She pleaded with Brad to go back for them, but he wouldn't. Jess was not yet 12, Michael was 9, and Philip was 7. It would be dark soon. What if the boys tried to find their way back and got on the railroad tracks? What if some pervert found them out there alone? After a long, long time, Brad turned the car around and drove back to where he had left his sons. They were waiting there, huddled together, and Jess quickly confessed to losing the puzzle ring. "But I don't think he did it. He just confessed to save the others," Dana said. "Brad did that often, dumping the kids way out in the Tulies someplace. I think he always went back because he needed them. He used to tell me, 'These children are my assets.'" The strange summer of 1992 passed. They were living in a picturesque paradise, but Dana felt as if she and the three boys were moving through a minefield, never sure what Brad might do next. In the fall, they went back to Washington and moved into a much smaller house in Mill Creek, rented again in Dana's name. Dana knew she had to get away from Brad, but this time she was planning her escape carefully.
I'd cut off my family so Brad couldn't write to them. I had no contact with them. I really had no contact with them, so it wouldn't do him any good to start sending letters and faxes again.
Dana told Brad she wanted to move out for a little while. She didn't dare give him the impression that she was leaving him for good.
I told him, I can't live with you all the time, but I'll still be with you. I won't be out of your life totally. I'll see you on Sundays, and I'll be here for holidays and for the boys' birthdays. You'll all be living with Uncle Herm soon, and I'll be with you a lot.
Brad watched Dana's face carefully, searching to see if she was telling him the truth. He had always found her transparent, and, of course, he considered her vastly inferior to him in intelligence.
"I guess he half believed me," Dana remembered. "He let me go, but he stalked the crap out of me. My tires were slashed. There were bullet holes in my bedroom window. Once I found a stack of bills in his room from the Blue Moon Detective Agency. He'd hired them to follow me."
Dana couldn't support herself cutting hair and selling makeup, or perhaps she could, but Brad had introduced her to a lifestyle that was hard to forget. She found a job dancing at one of the places on the strip north of Seattle. Rainbows wasn't nearly as classy as the men's club, but Angel was back in business and was soon a favorite with the crowd. She was living the life that Brad had programmed her for. Dana kept her promise to be with Brad and the boys on weekends, even though she knew that he was either following her himself or paying Blue Moon to do it. She was there for Philip's 9th birthday party just before Thanksgiving. To this day, she can recite Jess's, Michael's, and Philip's birthdays, date and year, by rote. Like all their mothers, she cared about Brad's sons. That fall, Brad talked continually of new building projects and what he would do with all the money he was going to realize from his Texas lawsuit. Herm and Trudy Dreesen were still supportive, but Trudy was terminally ill. Her breast cancer had metastasized to her bones. Even so, she was helping take care of Jess, Michael, and Philip. Herm Dreesen listened to Brad talk about the money to be made from multiple unit construction projects. No one could be more convincing than Brad. He knew real estate, he knew banking, and he knew construction. If he hadn't had a problem with his contractors in Houston, he would have been a rich man by now. But Brad was still only 44, and he was prepared to share his knowledge with his Uncle Herm, who was a dozen years older. Herm and Trudy Dreesen had been good friends with a couple their own age for a long time.
"Herm approached us about going in together on some property development," the wife would recall. "The way it began, Herm was going to put up the money, and we were going to put in this piece of property we had. It sounded like a good idea, and Herm introduced us to his nephew, Brad Cunningham. We liked him at first. He was charming and knew the business, and it sounded like a great idea. We thought it would be wonderful."
The Dreesen's friends tore down an existing house on their property, a rental, in preparation for the construction of a 42-unit apartment complex.
"Right away, we lost our income from the rental," the wife said. "And, of course, we had the cost of the demolition and clearing. And then this Brad Cunningham, Herm's nephew, wanted us to co-sign for $1.25 million loan. We had understood that our part was to provide the land."
It got worse. They also discovered that if they did agree to sign for the loan, there were clauses stipulating that they would have absolutely no control over how the loan was administered. Brad would handle all the money.
"We pulled out, and there were hard feelings with Herman, and we felt bad," the husband said. "But we couldn't co-sign on a loan that large and have no say in how it was spent. We lost the house, but we still had the land."
Brad was furious with them for not having the vision to let him handle their land and their money. It clearly was to have been his way back up the ladder of success. Meanwhile, the suit in Texas dragged on as Vincent and Elkins continued its work on the case. Brad had always intimidated Dana, and now he scared her. By that fall of 1992, I had started carrying a gun for protection, she said. I didn't think much about it at the time, but at Philip's birthday party, Brad asked to borrow my gun. He just said, I need your gun, and I said, not a problem, and gave it to him. I realized later that he had something planned for me, and he wanted to make sure I wasn't armed. Dana had made a platonic friend of one of the muscular bouncers at Rainbow's, Denny Johnson. On December 9th, Brad and Dana argued, and she could sense he was working up toward the kind of raid she had seen before. She called Denny and asked him for protection. And then she decided to pack her things and move to another location where it wouldn't be so easy for Brad to find her. I was going to meet Denny at the Fred Meyer store parking lot. I tried to put my stuff in the trunk of my car. It was a 1989 Mitsubishi, but the trunk lock seemed to be broken. I couldn't get it to turn. I just threw my stuff in the back seat and headed for Fred Meyer. I waved Denny down, and he stood by while I forced my trunk open. There was a body in her trunk. Dana screamed when the body moved, and Denny drew his handgun and shouted, "Whoever's in there, get out!" Brad, a phantom-like figure dressed completely in a black spandex bodysuit, crawled out of Dana's trunk. With Denny Johnson standing by, he had no choice but to leave. I called my dad, and he called the Oregon State Police, Dana said, and we both gave reports to them. I think that Brad borrowed my gun deliberately at Philip's party because it was only 2 days after that when he was hiding in my trunk, dressed like that. If I'd been alone... Brad had a ready excuse for hiding in Dana's trunk. I was only trying to hook up a listening device, he told her, as if to say, doesn't everybody? A cousin recalled visiting Brad in late 1992 or early 1993. Brad bragged that the previous spring, after Dana called the authorities and they had surrounded his block, he had driven through the police lines 5 times and they never knew who he was. He was apparently amazed to see them there. They tore up my house, he said plaintively. He told his cousin that Dana had been kidnapped by the Oregon State Police then and that they were keeping her now in Portland against her will. Brad's preoccupation with what law enforcement officials in Oregon were doing was obvious, and 6 years after the fact, he gave his cousin yet another version of where he was on the night Cheryl died. He started mumbling about how he couldn't have killed Cheryl. He said he wasn't even in Oregon the night she died. He said he was in a laundromat in Bainbridge Island. With Dana gone, Brad had become what he had always said he was, a primary parent. His 3 young sons were now completely at his mercy. Chapter 54. Brad might have walked away from his civil judgment, but he had not shrugged off the losses in his life as easily as he pretended. He was growing more and more paranoid. He had every reason to feel paranoid. Since late January 1993, a grand jury in Washington County had been listening to some 91 witnesses describe the events leading to Cheryl's murder. For 9 weeks, the jurors met behind closed doors, and since grand jury proceedings are secret, no one knew if they were close to handing down a criminal indictment of murder against Brad. When he realized he no longer had Dana under his control, Brad was shocked that she, of all his women, had been able to walk away from him.